It's certainly true, it's certainly clear to anyone who's paying any attention that the church this time of year is looking beyond this world. The whole month of November is like that. It becomes very clear in tomorrow's feast day, the Feast of Christ the King, the only major feast that celebrates something that hasn't happened yet, that is the second coming of Christ or the revelation of Christ in glory. So we're looking beyond this world and beyond the present time. All week we've been reading from the book of Revelation, which reveals what is to come. It also reveals how we are to live now because of what is to come. Now, the mysterious character of the future, of the next life, remains. We know that Christ will come again. We know that there's a judgment. We know that there's reward and punishment. We're sure of these things. It's right in our faith, central elements of our faith. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, we say in the Creed. But even though we have certainty about the future, we don't have particular details revealed to us. It's a little bit murky. I think of what St. Paul says about looking into a mirror. Well, in those days, mirrors weren't very good quality. They were just shiny metal. So you could see, but it wasn't really like seeing face to face. He said, in the future, we'll see clearly, but right now it's kind of cloudy. This is actually true for even non-Christian cultures and peoples. Most people have some vague idea of what the afterlife is about, and so, you know, the traditions about people being shades in the underworld, or people who, after they die, their body might die, but their soul is put into some other creature, reincarnation. They might come back as a cat or a cow or something. Rat, I don't know, or a person, or a king. So that's what some people believe. And, you know, cultures have these ideas that when someone dies, what they have in this life somehow continues. Great example, the Egyptians, when they buried the pharaohs, well, they buried them with lots of food and clothing and expensive jewelry, and sometimes they even buried slaves with them. So that when they enter into the next life, they have everything they need. Now, everyone knows that it can't work like that. Even the Egyptians knew that if you dug them up 100 years later, that all that stuff would still be there. But somehow they sensed that there's something like this life in the next life. I've used this analogy before, but I think it's a valid one. What we know about the future is something like watching a trailer of a movie, a preview of a movie. Maybe this is in my mind because when I was on the plane last week, I see a lot more trailers than I see movies, because what they do is they let you pick the movies and you can see the trailer first, and usually the trailer reveals, I don't want to see that movie anyway. So maybe I have this experience fresh in my mind. With a trailer, the movie's 2 hours long, and the trailer's only 2 minutes long. So you can say in 2 minutes, you can see what kind of movie it's like. You can see whether it's a comedy or an action movie, or most movies now are comic books and things like that, or romances. And you can see what culture it's set in, the 18th century, or it's set in the future, or science fiction. You can tell right away. And you can tell some significant moments, you know, the castle gets blown up, or the heroes kiss or something. And so you know these things are part of the movie, but you don't know everything. Usually we even know whether it has a happy ending or not, even from the trailer. You say this is going to end happily, or it's going to end in, you know, a lot of disaster. But you don't know the rest. So this is something like what we know from the book of Revelation and from what Jesus reveals. We know a lot of the basics, but we don't know the details. If you've ever had this experience of watching a trailer after you have already seen the movie, then you realize how those things all fit together. Sometimes the trailers don't even put things in order. It's just a jumble of attractive scenes or scenes that will make us want to see the movie. So something like that is happening here. Here in the first reading, we have a very mysterious description of two witnesses. So it's a glimpse of something, but it's not exactly clear who these two witnesses are. Even the scholars debate about this. Most of them say probably Moses and Elijah, but the description doesn't exactly fit them either. Some people say Peter and Paul. Just celebrated their basilicas yesterday, Peter and Paul. But anyway, what we have here is a mysterious revelation of two chosen figures, two good people, two servants of God, who start out with great power, with great effect, who can call down fire, who can afflict the earth with plagues whenever they want to, who can stop the rain from falling. And then, after they have given their testimony, they've completed their mission, evil forces rise up and persecute them and kill them. Yesterday we read about the scroll that was sweet and then sour. This reading is sweet and then sour, but then at the end of the reading it's sweet again, because these two witnesses, they're also called prophets, they're sweet, they have power, they're very effective, they're chosen by God and gifted. Their life turns sour because evil rises up and kills them, and then their bodies are left in the street for 3.5 days, and everybody's rejoicing that they're finally dead. That's the sour part. And then, after 3.5 days, they are raised, not only raised back to life, they are taken up to heaven in a cloud. That's even sweeter than their earthly life. So this little trajectory from an earthly experience of sweetness to the earthly experience of brutal persecution and absolute defeat, to being raised up again to an even greater sweetness, this is a revelation of the journey of the church and of the journey of each believer. It's not only two people, it's everybody. Certainly this is the experience of the prophets, the experience of anyone who gives testimony, who is a witness to Jesus Christ. This is clear throughout the New Testament, this is how it works. Okay, so I think this passage, which is a revelation, what it reveals to us is the whole itinerary of the journey of faith. Sweet, sour, then very sweet. So, joyful mysteries, sorrowful mysteries, glorious mysteries. This is everywhere in our faith. Still, we have a tendency to use what we know of this life to define or try to categorize what the next life will be like. And this has very limited application, or it meets very limited success. Today's gospel is a great example. The Sadducees, who don't believe in a vague underworld or land of shades, or they believe there is no life after death. So they're more like deniers. They don't believe in reincarnation. They don't believe in ghosts. They don't believe in the life of the soul after this life. So they come up with this story, which is intended to make the teaching about life after death look ridiculous, because to the mind of the Jews, it would be impossible to think of one woman marrying 7 men at the same time. Nowadays, because we live in a disordered era, it's not impossible for people to think about it. There are even people who are proposing, since marriage, the definition of marriage has been shattered in popular culture and in law, marriage can be just about anybody and anybody else, and any number of anybodies. So the most common variation on this is one man with more than one wife, but now there are these proponents of what they call polyandry or polyamory, any number of people live in what they call a marriage, and it's crazy, and it's gravely immoral, but it's not impossible to imagine anymore. But in the time of the Sadducees, if you talked about one woman with seven husbands, everybody would say impossible, can't be. And since it's impossible, therefore, there can't be any life after death, because this woman really did marry seven men, and logical impossibility. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning it this way is because it reveals our tendency to take human experience or experience of this life and apply it to the next. And that, like I say, it meets very limited success. So, and this is how it often happens. People identify what is good in this world. And it is good. Let's say good food. And then they say, well, if it's good in this world, then, and if there's life after death, well, there must be better food in heaven. And it's true, but not the way we think. We don't have to eat in heaven. And yet we are fed with bread from heaven. Or people think money is what makes for a good life. So if money, possessions, is what makes for a good life here, well then the next life, there must be more money, more possessions, more of what we want, more stuff. Something like the Egyptians and the Pharaohs. So they wanted to make sure they had all their good stuff with them in the next life. Gosh, some people think that pleasure is what makes life good. Some people are so attached to sexual pleasure that that's what they think has to exist in heaven. You say, well, pretty limited view of heaven if you're boxing it into what you think is good on earth. All good things come from God, and all good things point to something that lasts. But passing things do not remain. They're just indicators of what remains. And Jesus has to explain to the Sadducees, there's no earthly marriage in heaven. There's no marriage as you understand it, you Sadducees, in heaven. The marriage in heaven transcends the marriage on earth. The experience of communion that reaches its height in earthly marriage reaches a transcendent height in heaven. The marriage of God and the church, the great marriage feast. So those who are deemed worthy of the resurrection, or are judged to be recipients of eternal life, they don't marry like people marry in this life. That marriage in that sense ends when one of the spouses dies. But there is something greater than marriage, and that's what we look forward to. They are like angels. They are children of God. They are the ones who rise. These are all true statements, but they don't give us absolute clarity of what it means to be like an angel, or what it means to be a child of God, or what it means to rise. But we know it's true. God is not God of the dead, but of the living. He continues to talk about the Lord is the Lord of life, and everybody who is welcomed by God and everyone who welcomes the gift of life reigns with him forever. This is part of what we're going to celebrate tomorrow. Feast of Christ the King is, yes, the feast of Christ himself reigning forever in glory as King of the universe, but it's also the feast of everyone who reigns with him. Because God establishes his reign as a kingdom of love. And there's no sense having a kingdom of love if there aren't people around to love. He wants to share glory. He wants to share love, communion. So that's what his reign is all about, the universal reign of love. This is what we have to look forward to. So with this awareness of what God has already revealed, and with the awareness that we don't yet understand fully when or how it comes about, with the understanding that the period of sourness is part of the journey, we continue to look forward. We continue to strive to go forward. into eternal life.